This is Jen Grisanti, and you are listening to The Break It Down Show.
And now, The Break It Down Show with John and Pete.
Jen Grisanti, thank you for coming.
Yeah. Aw, thank you so much for having me.
We're at a lovely office on the corner of Hollywood and Vine.
Yes, we are.
That was provided for us by Hilliard Guest, who's with us.
What's up, y'all?
So, we got a twofer today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? It's a beautiful day. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it is. It's gorgeous out. So, for an introduction, tell our listeners about the interesting thing that you do for a living.
I am a story career consultant for writers, and I'm the writing instructor for Writers on the Verge at NBC.
So she's very important.
Yes.
I'm a former 12-year studio executive, so I kind of took what I learned in the studio and put it into a business.
You know the building blocks of a story.
Mm-hmm.
When someone's going to try to, I'm going to write myself my first script, and you know they're in love with their story, you're able to say, it's a good story. Here are the things that you have to adjust and change. Is that pretty fair? Like, were you able to take their 80% solution and fill holes in that they may not even be aware of?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I have studied story for 23 years now.
Wow.
So, and Aaron Spelling was my mentor for 12 years.
Who's that? You never heard of him.
And so, it is a puzzle. You look at story, and every day I have 2 to 3 consults a day, and you are pulling apart story, figuring out where the holes are, figuring out what is going to elevate it to the next level emotionally, structurally figuring out what's not working that could be working, and it is an incredible business to be in, I have to admit. I love my job.
It's an honor.
I'm very passionate about this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on the Break It Down Show, we typically talk about a person's process and how you go about doing that.
Yes.
I mean, it's one thing to say, I look at your script and I look at the emotions and I try to pump up here. But,
yeah.
But how do you, yes, you've done it for 23 years.
Yeah.
But what do you do? Like when you read, do you read through the script the whole time, one time through? Before you pick up a pen?
So what my process is I usually read a script 3 times. So I usually read it the first time just to see where is the story going, kind of take mental note of what's working, what's not working. Then the second time I'm going through the notes, and then third time I'm briefly going through just to make sure that I didn't miss anything the other time. It is, and I think what is so fascinating.
Talk about cross-checking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's so fascinating, because I realize that the brain misses things. Like the first time you're reading a story, and as an executive, I mean, when you had 300 scripts behind you for staffing season, you could only read a script 1 time. Now
there's only so many hours.
As a current executive, I mean, we would read the scripts for the shows 2 and 3 times because we were giving notes to the network, we were giving notes to the showrunner, and everything was going to hit the air. So I got trained that way, and I got to see what worked and what didn't work on up to 5 shows a week when I was at Spelling and then at CBS Paramount. And so for my process, I'd read it 3 times. I would say the biggest things I look for, like when I break it down, is I look for, in pilots, I look for, does the series trigger and dilemma link to the pilot trigger dilemma in pursuit?
Explain it.
Yeah, wow. That was a technical way to say something that I really want to know what that means.
No, that was good. Yeah. I got it, but I want to hear it.
Yeah, so... I came, like, after I left the studio in 2007, I studied story. Like, when you're an executive and you're thrown into it and you're going off of instinct and you're seeing your notes made, there's still so much. And you're reading storybooks, you're going to seminars, but there's still so much because you're so busy that you can't immerse yourself into it. And so when I sold Storyline, the first book that I wrote, I knew that I recognized that I had what made my voice different as a screenwriting author. And so what I recognized at that point is I had been an analyst for 17 years. Mm-hmm. So I got a bunch of Golden Globe, Emmy nominated, and Oscar nominated scripts, and I extracted a formula. And the formula I extracted was what I just described. For feature films, it was the idea of, people would refer to it as the inciting incident. Mm-hmm. But for me, with my clients, what I began to recognize is if I call it the trigger incident, and I say that this is the moment that pushes a central character into a mm-hmm. dilemma. And then what I discovered was the choice that's made in the dilemma is what defines the external goal. And then every obstacle, escalating obstacle, all is lost moment, links back, has to link back to the goal.
To the choice.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And when the goal isn't clear, mm-hmm. that's when the story doesn't work.
Okay. Yeah. That's when it's so loose and we can't, well, we don't, I don't care about that guy.
You don't know what the person wants. Right. And what's at stake.
Yeah. So I used to always tell people always ask me, how do you know what the theme is? And I said, you ever go to a movie and you go, I don't know what that was about. Because it wasn't about one thing.
Yes.
And everything she said leads back to that one thing.
Mm-hmm. The one thing.
All the
thing.
Way through.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
the way through.
Yeah.
Like you, I think the biggest, when I first started consulting, the biggest question that I would ask is, what does the central character want? Mm-hmm. And I get this blank look. I can't even tell you how many times. And I thought, okay, now this is going to, and what I became, what I came to recognize psychologically is most people have no idea what they want in their own lives. And because they don't know what they want, it's hard to completely define what the character wants. Mm-hmm. But the gift is when you're writing fiction, you get to define those things. You get to say, this is what my character wants.
He wants his daughter back. He yeah. wants his yeah. whatever the thing yes. is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I think when people accuse a story of being too simple or too formulaic, you know, maybe we watch something and we go, yeah, that was so predictable. Of course the guy wants his daughter back. And then of course we're fulfilled at the end because he gets his daughter back. But you could say, you could see another story where the exact thing happens on that simplistic level, but we love it. So when there's a difference in those two things, mm-hmm. where do you find, what are the subtleties that create that difference?
My biggest discovery was the recognition that when the personal dilemma connects to the professional pursuit, then you elevate the emotion. So say, for example, television show-wise, in The Good Wife, mm-hmm. we know at the beginning, the series arc is Peter goes to jail, so Alicia loses her breadwinner. Mm-hmm. So with Alicia losing her breadwinner, she no longer has security for her family. So she returns. So the question becomes, what does a woman who loses her breadwinner do to bring security back to her family? And the answer to that question is the series. She returns to a law career she abandoned 13 years before. Mm-hmm. And then you recognize when you add complications, like, by the way, the guy who hired her was her college sweetheart.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then you add different elements, and what we know is the personal dilemma is she needs to bring security back to her family. So we know that every obstacle that she hits in the first legal case she gets, what's at stake is bringing security back to her family. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
when it's done right.
Yeah.
Right?
When it's done right.
Correct. Yeah.
Correct.
So for our listeners, if you haven't already listen to our episode with Hilliard Guest, you should go back and do that. For familiarity's sake, do that after you're done listening to this episode. But for familiarity's sake, Hilliard hosts the Screenwriter's Rant Room, which you should listen to if you have any interest in this stuff, especially if you're a writer or interested in writing. Absolutely listen to Hill's show. We love it. We listen to it. So, okay, now those are the differences. Let me pitch to you a practical case, and then you can start to help us understand what's wrong with it.
Okay.
Let's say, hypothetically, that Pete and I are going to recreate the streets of San Francisco.
Oh, boy.
And that... Except it's going to be a little different. You see, we don't have Carl Malden and Michael Douglas. We have John and Pete. Two somewhat washed up detectives, a couple of fat dudes lumbering through San Francisco.
Hoping and dreaming that there's a murder at the It's It factory. It would be like ice cream sandwiches.
And we need to investigate there. That place needs to be investigated very frequently. But this place
is an action comedy.
Yes. What is funny about It's It? This is serious stuff here. So when we get we get to the show, what we see is a recreation of those two characters, but in Pete's form and my form, which are, once again, two guys who like ice cream and other things related to ice cream. So one of the quirks about the show is Pete and I start developing this thing. We never once, and I'm not kidding, we have had conversations about developing this. Just two dudes in a car on a road trip.
Right.
We would have conversations about how this show should look and what we should feel about the show. Never once, or correct me, Pete, if I'm wrong, never once did we understand what do these two guys want? Besides, they like dim sum.
Right. Yeah.
They like ice cream.
They like
a couple
ice cream.
Fat dudes.
They're moving on plot. Everything's plot.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think you're exactly right. I thought in terms of this little tiny little beat, and not even a whole scene, but like one of the things that always happens in San Francisco is people are always moving their one apartment lives every second of the day. So there's always someone carrying a double
couch down a San Francisco steep hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we wanted that element in there. That part we got covered, but why?
Exactly.
Yeah. We've never discussed
tension?
That reason.
Tension? There's no tension.
It's just tension.
No,
like, I'm chasing this guy and you guys have a cat. What are you doing? and then there's the other element we wanted to exercise was, there were two other central elements we wanted to exercise. One was that whatever part of town we found ourselves in at the end of the pursuit where we lost the guy, we would say, oh, we lost him. There's an Italian joint right around the corner that's terrific. Why don't we regroup over some cannelloni or something? And then the other thing was, whenever there was an assailant who would take off running, Pete and I would look at each other and go, I got the last one. This one is, I got the, come on, man, my knee. No, never mind your knee. I got the last one. You get this one. So, we just kind of wanted to play on those elements, but not once did we understand or figure out an understanding of what it was we wanted. Yeah. What do we want?
It sounds like they just had a bunch of scenes in their head. Like there's no real story.
You wanted
story.
A donut at the end of it, all right?
Yeah. When we do that 3-episode arc where we have to come to Los Angeles and work with the LAPD, we're going to end up at Randy's. We're going to end up, that's all we had.
Well, I think it's fascinating. Like when you look at your own personal arcs, an exercise that I have writers do is called Logline for Your Life. And in a Logline for Your Life, the formula is set up of who, create empathy, dilemma, action, goal. And then if you're an advanced writer, twist of irony. So through getting writers to do Logline for their lives, which it's easy for us to draw a story from our lives because we know the sequence of events. So we can put it within the framework of a log line. And as soon as, ideally, like when I started doing the exercise in 2008, I did it as
long?
Crazy? As an icebreaker. I know. It's so wild. I thought, God, this January is going
to
be 8 years
you
old.
You have to pitch your own.
Okay.
Because every time I heard it, I'm like, that should be wrong.
I wish I had known that. Do you know, it's funny.
It's so simple, but it is
so simple.
So
like
good.
When you look at my fictional one, I wish I had the other ones memorized. I don't. I have them in all my books, but my fictional one. Okay, so one of my first personal moments was a long relationship that ended in a short marriage. So the fictional logline is when a young bride obsessed with fairy tales, falls through a rabbit hole, she wakes up and finds herself president of Cheated on Anonymous.
That's hilarious.
See, you want to know what's so funny? I can't tell you how many times I've shared that in rooms where the room will break out and laugh. I had one room where nobody because they were afraid to laugh. Wow. And I, as soon as I said it's okay to laugh, everyone laughed. Ah, and I was like, no, we have to take those moments and find humor, you know? And then as a studio executive, I mean, my next big moment, that is behind my blogs and the reason I sold my book, Change Your Story, Change Your Life, is, you know, I was in mid pursuit of what I thought was what I wanted, which was running a studio. And I was,
you were right around the corner.
Yeah, I was right around the corner. And I got interrupted mid pursuit. I didn't anticipate this. I had 5 shows. They were all coming back. I got in an argument with the wrong person on the wrong day and it was gone. And so I think in that moment, the universe nudged me. Like I remember having fantasies about all these executives who their contracts weren't picked up, but they got paid out. And I thought, I want that. I kind of manifested it. So I think, you know, that was my nudge and that led to another log line, which led to me selling the book, Change Your Story, Change Your Life, A Path to Success. And the concept of that book is a story expert teaching people how to be the author and active hero in their own life so that their story reflects the type of life they want to be living and they have something to write.
And that's one of the things, I don't know if you guys had a chance to read this book. It's one of the books that I'm always telling everybody to read, especially people who, well, you know, I'm a big fan of you. We've known each other for a long time.
I don't want to interrupt this kernel of thought you have, but I want to come back to it after you explain to our listeners your relationship with Jen.
Okay. You want me to tell that part first?
Will you please?
Yeah, no problem. Well, Jen has this thing she's been doing for years. You still do it, right? I haven't been in a long time. Mm-hmm. But she has this thing she does on tell people what it's
Friday night.
Friday night.
Friday night drinks. Now we call it Friday night social because we recognize that some people drink, some people don't.
True.
So,
I'll come to anything called Friday night drinks.
Oh, and sometimes the word ice cream goes in front of social.
Exactly.
It sometimes does. And I started that in 2006.
Okay. And that's about when I started going. Yeah.
When I was an executive.
I met you either there or I met you at OBS.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, because I teach at OBS.
Yes.
So sometimes, but Jen used to come through there. I used to always bring a bunch of people. We'd go to her Friday night socials and stuff like that. I just haven't been. I've been.
It was called Friday Night Drinks. And then Hill showed up. Hill doesn't drink.
And I don't drink. So, Jesse, you don't be drinking either when you're there,
too. I don't drink a lot. Trust me.
You got work to do.
Yeah, I got work to do. Exactly.
You know, whenever I'm having a party at my house, my son likes to kind of nudge me and go, "You're not really drinking that much, huh?" And then I have to go,
No, when you have an incentive and an intention.
Right.
You have to
You got to regulate.
Clear. Yeah.
But here's something that I like about you, Jen. You're the type of person who every time I see you, you're the same person. Oh. And we might have talked about this at some point.
So, yeah.
There are some people who, when you see them, they have different personalities, right?
Yeah.
They're not consistent.
Right.
You're the same, smiling, sweet, consistent, which is why she's still here today. You know, which is why you're able to start a new career and have writers like myself who trust you and believe that other writers should go to her.
Right.
Now, this industry, and this is something we talked about just before you got here, but this industry.
Right.
And we can be caught up in the glitz of this industry right now because I want to point out that out that window, we're looking at the Capitol Records building.
We are.
And the Hollywood sign.
Uh-huh.
So we're right in the spot. This industry, though, is like any other. This industry rewards the hard work. It rewards the sincerity. Sometimes. It rewards the...
Not enough.
No.
Well, maybe not.
We'd all be millionaires.
But it doesn't like when you don't put the work in.
No.
Yeah.
So for the folks who come here and say, oh man, you know what? I got an idea. It's an, as you said it earlier, Hill, Hollywood doesn't like idea people. You gotta get the idea out. You gotta put it down. You gotta
Execute
the work.
It.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to recognize, I remember one manager said, which I loved it. It was, if you're not going to give it 5 years, don't give it 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. At least 5 years.
At least. I would say most of the writers that I've worked with that have launched into very successful careers, it's 7 to 10 year journey before that point happens.
7 to 10 years, listeners. Let's put it this way for the layperson out
way
there
more
who's
than
thinking. Yeah, way more. If you're doing it right.
Right.
The 7 to 10 year journey, that is when you get good enough. Write that down, people.
Yeah.
Your script is not good enough 7 to 10 years before it gets good.
And that we've heard this, so we interview a lot of people who do a lot of things.
Right.
Comedians. Mm-hmm. No one shows up on day two with an act for 30 minutes headline, and it takes years of hard work on the road, way more than 10,000 hours.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, 10,000 hours is 5 years or 40 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
No, that ain't going to cut it. You're going to be...
It's a good base. Yes. Like you look at it, and it's good for people to hear that and to recognize. And occasionally you'll hear stories of people... But even when you hear the overnight stories, there's still 5 to 10 years that you're not hearing about, you know, but it, I think it's a journey. And with writing, I'm definitely a believer that the older you get, the better you are.
Correct.
If you like the show, and you know you do, support the show. There are three ways you can support us. Number one, go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. And leave a 5-star rating and review. It helps with the show metrics and helps us get better placement. Number two, visit our website, www.breakitdownshow.com. We've got an Amazon and an eBay link. Same Amazon, same eBay, you know and love, but they give us a little kickback when you get to their site from ours. And number three, leave comments about the shows that you like. We want to know what you think, how you feel. Tell us how to make the show better. We greatly appreciate it. Now back to the show.
I have this conversation all the time. I'm on three different committees at the Writers Guild, right?
Yeah.
And I'm on the Education Committee, the Gay and Lesbian Committee, and the Black Committee. And on the Education Committee, it's full of mostly, I'm the youngest person in the, maybe there's one or two. I just turned 45. I know I look like that girl. And, shut up, Jan. And
you look great.
I do, Anna.
Yes, you do.
And
not a bad looking man.
I know. And we have conversations all the time about people over 40-ish. Actually, let's say people over 50. Most of them have an issue with, well, how am I going to get into TV when I'm over 50 and yada, yada, yada. I mean, I can't even relate to a kid that age. So me and Jeff Melvoin and a bunch of other people, we ended up having this long conversation, which turned into me making a bold statement that caused, not necessarily some friction, but it just caused an argument. And what it was this. One of the older, very popular film writers made a comment that he needed to move into TV, but he's over 50. How am I going to be yada, yada, yada? And I said, well, I have a question for you. He said, well, I says, do you listen to, I said, what's playing in your car right now?
Right.
He said, what do you mean? I said, like, what's on the radio?
Right.
He goes, NPR. I said, problem number one.
Yeah.
He said, what do you mean? I says, great, you're learning some shit.
Right.
But you're not hip on what's going on.
Yeah.
I said, how often do you turn on MTV or, you know,
yeah,
to see what's going on? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He goes, like, cause his question was, I can't even have a conversation with a 30-year-old, you know, executive. And I said, see, that's the problem.
It is the problem.
You guys do nothing.
Yeah.
To try to fit in with
those
people at
all. If you have kids, like Aaron Spelling had Randy Spelling mm-hmm. when he was 54.
Oh, wow.
So he always said
that'll keep you young.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Between Randy and Tori, it kept him hip. He would always talk about that. I think when you look at writers who are in their 50s who want to move into the business, that it their own ment they get in their own way.
Sure.
So I think it's easier to say, I'm not going to do that or I can't do that. Because of my age, because then they somehow think it justifies why they're not making it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Versus doing the work, putting forth 150% effort, believing in what they're writing and putting it out there. And I definitely think, you know, and I work with writers from staff level all the way up to co-executive producer. I've had now 36 writer cell pilots. And 5 go to series. Mm-hmm. And of those 5 that went to series, 2 were by new writers, which is so rare.
Okay.
You know? Yeah.
Wow.
You know? You know? And so I think that the common ingredient of every writer who I've worked with who has made it is belief. Plain and simple.
That's really important.
And it's not,
it's like getting, it's like playing football or baseball. Yeah. You cannot play if you don't believe you're going to hit the ball.
You have to believe.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I was curious about with you, and you're answering the question mm-hmm. as we go, actually, is how do writers feel about you? Because there's really, you know, you could take it one of two ways, like, hey, this person really needs to get out of my way, or this person is coming in to fix my story and embrace the process. But there is, in that belief, there is a little bit of ego.
Yes.
And sometimes that ego can say, I don't want you to mess with my story. It's a great story. I think it's terrific. Other people think it's terrific. I don't want your input. And when that resistance
But by the time they come to gym, they have to have made their mind that they're going to.
Would you say? It's an investment.
Yeah.
So for me, if they're coming to me, they're mm-hmm. paying money.
Yeah.
And if they have to be ready to invest in themselves. Now, I have definitely hit writers mm-hmm. who, what you have to recognize, and as a current programming executive, I got plenty of experience with it, is you have to recognize that you are criticizing their baby. So what you have to do, what Aaron Spelling taught me, was you have to talk about what works first.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get them in the right state of
mind.
There's
an art to giving notes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you constructively give what's not working, what could work better, and then you go into the page notes mm-hmm. so that by the time you get there, and usually what I do with my meetings is I try to spend the first 10 to 15 minutes emotionally connecting with them. What's going on in your life right now? How did you feel about writing this script? Mm-hmm. Where were you at with your own hurdles? So that by the time we get into the notes, there's a trust, there's a security I have definitely come to find that it makes people not, the ego is always going to be there. You know, it's interesting.
And there's a place for it.
Always.
It should be there a little bit.
You need some of it.
You do.
You know, yeah.
You have to protect yourself with it. Like, I went to Sublime Primetime the mm-hmm. other night, mm-hmm. and not to name names, but it was fascinating to me.
Larry.
It was fascinating for me psychologically to watch Matthew Weiner of Mad Men,
mm-hmm.
because watching somebody who had the biggest success of their life with the show, mm-hmm. and now the show's over.
It's done.
So there's the psychological recognition that that moment may never come again.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
So he was so humble on stage and so revealing
mm-hmm.
because he's usually holding it all so uh-huh. close to the vest because mm-hmm. he doesn't want anybody to know the stories or this or that. And it was such a pleasure to watch him and see him just share. And give
and that level of honesty
and truth
mm-hmm.
and emotional truth and versus, mm-hmm. you know, I have to say the whole panel was egoless. Like it was such a great experience.
Rare.
It's so rare.
Especially when you're up there. Yeah.
It is so rare because like they had a guy, Alec from, Silicon Valley and mm-hmm. you're thinking, okay, well, he's right in the heat of it. Like mm-hmm. this show is killing it mm-hmm. in a major way. I mean, it's outstanding and yet, I think what he revealed that was so fascinating was, you know, we don't do it for the audience. We do it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like we do it for what do we think is going to be funny
mm-hmm.
and what is going to be our best work. And then we just pray that it's going to hit, which is a fascinating thing because I thought, oh my God, that's so good. And that's so revealing. And then Matthew talked about, because I thought, okay, there was one huge creative mistake that I thought was made on Mad Men. And he brought it up.
Did he really?
And he talked about it. And I was like, I love, mm-hmm. like when we get this inside glimpse and what
goes to the how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always talk about how.
Yeah.
How do you do? Don't just say, then I got an agent. Yes. Then I Motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the interesting part.
I love hearing you say this, and you probably have no idea about this. My background is I spent most of the last 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, right?
Wow.
And the things you're talking about are the things you're talking about are absolutely the things that I focused on, that I went out and talked to the locals.
Right.
And I would try to be the pivot between the locals and the military and the State Department and vice versa, right?
Right.
So I dealt with culture. You guys were just talking about culture a second ago. I'm 50 plus years old. How do I, you know, you have to get into their cultural marketplace.
Right.
And you should be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because then you're immersed in something that's not you, and it's so you can't blame it on culture anymore. You've seen, you've got to agree with their culture.
Yeah.
You've got to be uncomfortable because this isn't your home.
Yeah.
Now you're working in the right spot.
Sure.
But then also, like, the other thing is about the ego and watching someone's ego and how their ego impacts what their decisions are and everything. I would look for that all the time.
Yeah.
Commanders impose will. That's what military commanders do.
Yeah.
State Department people are highly educated and know everything. They're always the smartest person in the room, regardless of anything else that's going on around them.
Yeah.
And you have to, you can't coach them. You can't give them notes.
Yeah.
And say, everything you're doing is wrong, because they'll instantly reject you.
Right.
You know? So It's all story.
Like, you look at story. I mean, and my business is 8 years old, and I've started the idea of expanding into story and business. But entertainment has kept me too busy, so I haven't really been able to dive into it. But the little that I have dived into it, I got to speak at Google, and I got to speak to a healthcare group, and it's all story.
It is all story.
In everything we do and everything we sell, like, I've worked with entrepreneurs on figuring out what is their personal story. It's all about, like, even when you're thinking about a brand creation for a business, how does the personal dilemma connect to the professional pursuit? Mm-hmm. Say, for example, in my own brand, Jen Grisanti Consultancy, my personal dilemma was I had learned from some of the biggest icons in the business for 15 years. And then my job ended. Mm. So the dilemma was, what if everything I learned
is for naught?
Exactly. Has no value.
How do you bring it? Yeah.
How do I create a business where I can take everything I learned and make it available so that people's dreams can become a reality?
Yeah.
So
That's interesting. Let's talk about something really
good.
Because and I know you have come across them in your life. There's no way.
Right.
Meaning, because there's a lot of writers who think, well, why am I taking class from Jen or Pilar and all these people when they haven't written scripts? Now, I'm on your side.
Right.
I just want you to know.
Right.
And here's why.
There are two sides, though.
There are two sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt.
Always.
I'm on your side because, number one, there is no way to be right there with, why am I going blank on his name all of a sudden? The one you worked for all those years.
Aaron Spunk.
Forgive me.
Yeah, no worries. No worries.
What? There's no way to work that closely.
Right.
For all those years.
Yeah.
To read all those scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Which is everything we tell people to do to learn anyway. So why wouldn't she know?
Right.
You
yeah.
know what I mean?
That's the first thing, right? You want to learn how to
just
write.
Because
you have to read.
Actually done this.
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't mean you don't know.
You don't identify the great story.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the argument. Like, I think when people... I'll never forget, like, when I first opened my business, CAA was very big behind me doing it. And
did you pitch it to them?
Yeah, I went in and I pitched it to them, and they gave me my entourage moment because my Andy Elkin, my very close friend in the business, said, let me bring you in. I'm thinking in my mind there's going to be, like, three agents, and we're going to talk about my business. And he had them
around there.
He had, like, 18 of them around
and they fired up the presentation.
And then they
Pepsi Cola.
They had my website. I'm like, okay. And I think I probably turned 10 shades of red. But then other agencies followed suit. So, and it was more about, let's brainstorm about, she's not a manager, but how is this going to work for us? And one of the things they asked, like, one at another very big agency, he said exactly what you're saying. He said, well, how am I going to tell clients that sign with us, by the way, you should pay Jen Grisanti to make your scripts better? And another agent piped in, which I love what she said, is that's a much easier conversation than to have, we think you should give 10% to a manager. So it was, and I said, you know, my argument is why wouldn't you have them go to me? I have the studio executive perspective on what works mm-hmm. and what doesn't work about story. So if you can put your ego aside and really recognize that you're ready to do the work, why, no matter what level you are, and I've mm-hmm. had co-executive producers come to me who've sold pilots mm-hmm. or who've redefined their career because they burnt too many bridges. Mm-hmm. And we got into what worked, what didn't work, what could work, but it was all drawing from my experience mm-hmm. with people. So I think you have to, I definitely think there are arguments. I certainly know I've seen, you know, them saying, well, there are so many story consultants out there mm-hmm. who aren't legitimate. My feeling is, like when you mentioned Pilar, Lee Jessup, Carol mm-hmm. Kirshner, Kathy Bungunetta, I mean, Pamela J. Smith, Chris mm-hmm. Vogler, you know, Michael Haig, like there are incredible people out there who have fantastic credentials mm-hmm. and who have world views that are elevating story in such a massive way. So I think my feeling always is, why would you not get a sounding board? Like yeah. as a business person, I have coaches. Mm-hmm. I go to huge seminars. I pay $2,000 to $5,000 mm-hmm. to learn how to be better. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you not? You know?
And it's really silly yeah. if you yeah. think about it. If I was trying to, you know, if you're writing a resume and somebody says, well, I know the hiring manager at so-and-so, you know, I can get that person to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't want her. She's never written a resume. Mm-hmm. That's what that is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Because, I mean, I do know of, you know, being a writer, knowing a lot of writers. There are writers that I know who are like, oh, well, I would never pay one of those people to do it, and they've never done whatever. And I'm like, it makes no sense to me.
Right.
You know, and you've done fine. Yeah. And most of these people that I've experienced are writers who are on a show now, work their way up to co-EP, or, yeah. you know, something like that. So they never
got just far
to
enough to be
you.
Dangerous. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's yeah. easier for them, so mm-hmm. to speak.
Yes.
You know, to where they didn't have to deal with, like me.
Yeah.
Right. You know, out yeah. the system, yeah. working my butt off, trying to make this project, this, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So in direct
a,
line
you
of
need
fire.
A Pilar. Yeah. You, need
you can
that.
Get told
yeah.
no.
Correct.
Yeah. If you're insulated yeah. in the, you know.
Correct.
And I think there's all, like, many of us share clients, and there's something about all of our worldviews, and there have been a few of our clients that have launched into major things through gaining from all the perspectives. So mm-hmm. it's like you look at that, and again, you just go, why wouldn't you have the extra tools that you need to go the distance?
Yeah. This, the things you're talking about, again, it takes me back to my work, and you're yeah. talking about effect is one thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, okay, I'm going to write a script, and these are the things that are going to happen. Mm-hmm. You specialize, I think at least, in affect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you're I saying, like hey, look, this bit you of messaging right here, you could be 10% higher.
Yeah.
And if you get over 5%, you know, you're much more like, because I've read the scripts. I yes. know what happens. And if you add this much more, more powerful. And you also speak to it when you talk about how you present your notes.
Yeah.
You don't say, I'm going to establish rapport. Because to me, here's what I know about establishing rapport. It's bullshit. No right. one can tell you how to do it.
Right.
You said, I spend 15 minutes. I talk about what's going on in their life. Mm-hmm. I check in with them. Mm-hmm. And then I develop trust, which is, from my experience, is not a subset. Trust is subsequent after you establish rapport.
Right.
You might be given trust, but right. you haven't established trust.
Yes.
Until after you blown past
you're
rapport.
Right.
So you're working on an emotional affect level that we as Americans struggle with. We mm-hmm. don't deal with that very well. Other societies do that better, and they have less communication required to know these things.
Yes.
Right? But you're very, very good at it. Just from my own worldview that I've seen.
Thank you.
And I think that's what really makes you truly special. Is
you. Well, you're also a people is. Person.
You know? I'm a people person. You know, it's interesting. It was in the Republican debate the other night mm-hmm. when Trump was going back and forth with Carly, who I thought was beyond brilliant, at the debate. It was fascinating because I think it was Christie who chimed in, and he was like, America doesn't care about your jobs. They don't care about this track record and that track record and what you did there and what you did there. He said they care about their jobs. They care about the fact mm-hmm. that they don't have the money to bring home and this and this and that. And it was so fascinating to look at that because there was truth in both. They do care about leadership and background. Of course they care about that because they need to know that it's the right
people. You need to feel
strongly
that the right person is doing the job. They're smart enough.
Then they need the part you talked about. Then it's like, what is your life? What are your struggles? How can we affect, impact, and help what you're going through?
So really, I mean, you're again talking about story.
Yeah.
And those are the things that you would see in a story where, regardless of what the character is, because we're not all a hitman from New Jersey. We're not all a comedian from Los Angeles. We're not all, you know, but we're all a human being that knows that I really want that.
Yeah.
And if we can relate to the wanting, and we can, then we can go on that walk.
Yes.
We can go on that
journey. But we all know story.
Yeah.
We all might not know the craft of story.
We're all storytellers.
But we all know story. Right?
It's like since caveman days, like what I tell people over and over again, it's like you recognize what our life process is we go through highs and lows. We go through our falls. We get the tools to get back up. And then we pass those tools forward. That's what story is.
Let's talk about, remind me again, the process that when you say, okay, here's where we're going to start. You're going to apply these principles to your life and you're going to give me your log line. Can we just walk through that a little bit?
Yeah. So, and I've had many people say to me, like when they did the log line for their life, that suddenly they'd find they'd have 5 to 10 more stories to write.
Okay. That's the whole point.
Right.
Yeah. It's all inside. Like your emotional truth is your gold. Like when I get people who have had very difficult lives, and when we talk about it, when I'm in my seminars and I'll say, how many of you have gone through job loss, divorce, death, this, that, whatever. I said, I know. And I'd be like, because I'd be excited.
I can relate to you.
Exactly. So, you know what I mean?
Yay
so,
for adversity.
Exactly. And I think that what was discovered was, I said, let me tell you, that is your gold as a storyteller. Your ability to move through those life moments are what, because that's what story is. Story is something happens that throws your life out of balance.
Yeah.
And then you have to bring your life
back into balance.
So you have to know that. I'll never forget, like 8 years ago, I had an agent call me and he said, Jen, I have this amazing woman. And I said, tell me about her. What's her story? And this goes in and he said, her father was a pimp. Her mother was a prostitute. Her mother left when she was 2. Her father went into jail when she was 8. She went into the foster care system and then she put herself through school. And she's like this amazing woman. As soon as, and he said, and she's going to be on Oprah's couch someday. And she was.
Wow.
Yeah, this past year, her name is Tracy McMillan. And what is so fascinating was as soon as I heard that, I was like, I have to meet this woman. And the reason I had to meet her was she has something to say. She knows what it is to have choices made that had nothing to do with her, that threw her life out of balance. And she had to figure out how to get things back into balance. And she owned her story. There was no shame. It was, this is what it was. This is what I had to deal with. And now she's working constantly. She's written books, you know, and it is, I think she had a Huffington Post blog called Why You're Not Still Married. And I think the number one thing for women was you're a bitch. You know, so
that
I
might
think,
be why.
Like when you're walking through the process, so like say for example on a writer like Tracy, so you go through the idea of her personal dilemma is the in desire to have better
have
than
security.
What yeah, to bring security.
Because somebody like that would have abandonment issues too.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And dealing with, like she wrote a book called I Love You and I'm Leaving You Anyway.
Damn, that's a good title.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating thing. So when you have writers like that who get it, who know that, yes, they've had these dire circumstances, but they know how to spin it into gold. Because they know that those moments, as tragic as they were, they mean something, and there are millions of people going mm-hmm. through the same things that mean something. So when I work with writers, I like to figure out, number one, why are you the perfect writer to be telling this story?
That's a great question.
So
yeah,
that has to be, that's where Hollywood is right mm-hmm. now. They mm-hmm. need to know that you, no one can tell this story like you can.
If you can answer that question right. honestly,
mm-hmm.
never mind what the answer is. If you are the writer who can open up and answer that question honestly, that is such a big, big thing. Well, because if you can't, you're done.
Yeah.
Well, I was telling the guys off mic. I would say offline.
Right.
I was telling the guys off mic. I was just hired to do a rewrite on a new show for a new pilot for these guys who have a deal at HBO, like a first look.
Awesome. And congrats. So
when he put out a big blast for, you know, all these writers who was looking forward to do this rewrite, I looked at the thing and I went, what do I know that nobody else knows?
Yep.
I went, well, I'm kind of a rewrite king in essence. Mm-hmm. I mean, producers hire me all the time to do rewrites. And so in my heading, I wrote the rewrite king.
Yeah.
And I was telling them that.
Yeah.
And you were asking me, is that a bold statement? I said, it's kind of a bold statement, but it was kind of a true bold statement.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what I feel for myself.
Yep.
But there you go. That's the honesty of the, okay.
It wasn't
you
cocky.
Say you're the re, you it say wasn't you're the cocky. Yeah. Why would you say that? But yeah. you had an absolutely honest answer.
True. Yeah.
Now, for somebody, maybe they say, well, that's kind of not what we're looking for, and that's we're looking for this.
Mm-hmm.
But your answer was absolutely sincere. Mm-hmm. You knew within yourself what you
what
value. You.
Ricky Henderson stole the most bases ever and got him and said, I am the greatest. And mm-hmm. someone was talking to Dave Stewart, his buddy, right mm-hmm. about it. And he's like, isn't that kind of arrogant? And he's like, it's not arrogant if it's the truth.
Yeah. I love that.
You know?
There's nothing I love more than that.
Just
like, I love,
to the point, 5
when you know it, own it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, if you did rewrite creative.
There's a difference between arrogance and confidence.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. And it's a thin line.
And,
yeah.
and the difference is often line. Truth.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Yep.
True.
Can I ask you, you talked earlier about a twist of irony being for advanced people. Mm-hmm. And irony's hard anyhow.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I'm going to give an example. Hopefully we've all seen the movie Apocalypto. You watch this movie and they run through the damn jungle and I hated this movie.
Right.
Yeah, probably because the twist of irony sucked.
Right.
Know? So
right.
they run through the jungle. I know what the character wants. He wants his family back and everything else. And they go do all that. Then they get to the Mayan area and they run through the Mayan area for 45 minutes and they run back home. And then you see Spanish galleons off in the distance, and there's your twist of irony. It's like, all this crap happened, and now you're telling me, who the fuck cares? Everybody's going to die anyhow.
Right.
You know? And I'm just like, why? I mean, so that to me is what a twist of irony didn't work.
Right. Didn't. No, that right. doesn't.
It made the story worthless. Mm. Like, you took all my time.
Like, why did we do this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So give me an example of a good twist
I mean,
of
I
irony.
Think the easiest twist of irony story-wise is you look at Pretty Woman.
Oh, okay.
Richard Gere wanted to hire a prostitute so that he wouldn't fall in love.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what does he do? He falls in love.
Great one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that's why your hero always has to want something. Like he or she desires to save the family.
Right.
But what they really needed to do
yeah.
was go through the journey to right. realize they didn't need their husband after. You know, whatever. You know what I mean?
And it's people will define that as what is the need versus mm-hmm. what is the want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Correct.
I love this conversation.
It is
I
awesome.
Love this yes. conversation. I mean, we've been very fortunate and had great conversations, but this conversation specifically, there is so much flying around in my head. And I think our listeners are going to relate to this. Mm-hmm. Listeners, how many of your favorite movies did you just figure out right now? How many of your favorite movies did you just figure out? And how many of the movies that you thought sucked did you also just figure out right now?
Now they're going to have a problem, though.
No.
Uh-huh.
Because now right. they're going to go into the world where Gene and I do.
The curse
of
knowledge.
You can't even watch a movie.
Right.
Because all you do is dissect
uh-huh.
the movie or the TV show or whatever. You go, okay, we on page 6 now. This isn't even right.
Right.
I think the fascinating thing about it, and I get that asked that question all the time, yeah. and I think we all suffer from that. I think what I've learned, like when I look at mistakes made, mm-hmm. and I'm going to tell you, like I was on an Oscar panel like 3 or 4 years ago when Hugo and Moneyball were up.
Oh, yeah.
That year, I tell writers, like, we are always learning and growing. I always say teacher for a moment, a student for life. And I said, even these Oscar-nominated writers, the biggest mistake in story made that year mm-hmm. was failure to have a strong external stakes arc. We didn't know what the worst was that could happen. And because of that, you lost momentum in the story. So I think it is always, you know, figuring out, no matter where you get, you're always trying to figure out how to make it better. Like in True Detective this year. Well, the big thing that was very difficult, I think, for people psychologically, is because the first season was so freaking good that with Matthew McConaughey, that it in Woody Harrelson, that after the first episode, everybody was trashing it because they were comparing one episode against eight that they just saw. And yet, the fascinating thing was, like, I thought, no, I need to watch the whole season, and then I'm going to look at it versus last season. And what it is fascinating, because I think even when story doesn't work, like from our perspective, we'll say, oh, the structure's not working. Oh, if they had only done this, then that would. There are still perfect moments that make story work. There are perfect character moments that even when the structure isn't like in True Detective this year, I think he did a phenomenal job at creating wounds for Colin Farrell's character and Rachel McAdams' character that we got immersed in. Like, we went back to understand more about those wounds because of the way, but then the season arc was where it, the momentum didn't work in the way that it could have, in the way that it did the first season. But you still learn. That's what it is. Like, you have these people who are beyond brilliant writers. They're learning. They're just learning publicly. Like, they're just learning.
Sometimes lessons are tough.
When, you know?
When I was watching Alias way back in the mid-2000s. They're chasing, you know, all these artifacts from this Romaldi guy. And then at one point, they got to the season finale. It was like they ran out of ideas or ran out of arc. And it was like, I couldn't even bear to watch any show after that because they had ruined the show. Like, they didn't pay the bill. And I'm like, oh, you guys gotta be kidding me. This show is terrible now. And no matter how good that show was gonna be, I was emotionally totally done with that show. There's someone learning a lesson there because they had to have known that show was done at that point.
Sometimes I've been in a lot of writers' rooms. Sometimes you plot out how you think the season's gonna go.
Right.
And by the time you get midway in, you've already done all your big stuff. Because you started taking things from there and putting them back there. Thinking, oh, we'll figure that out. So then all that great stuff has been already down there. And then you can't get it
and
back.
And then you
again.
Can't. Or you'll have the thing, like, I'll watch shows where I can tell, and again, brilliant shows, where I can tell that there was no communication between what happened in the first half of the season and what happened because there were missing links. There were links that didn't make, that they had addressed, but they didn't, you couldn't tell that they addressed when they had these later episodes. And it's just communication and it's really researching and knowing how everything links. There's a great, have you seen Narcos?
I love it. I was just talking about Narcos today. The project I'm writing right now is a crime, freaking,
like, absolutely psychologically phenomenal.
I hated the pilot, though.
I hated the pilot. It was too much.
No, the show, no, it was too much.
We're talking about the Pablo Escobar series, right? Okay. Thank you for saying that because I just watched the pilot and I didn't like it.
It was too much. It was too much voiceover.
I know.
So I should stay with it.
You should stay with it, though. It does,
because it's a show
that
was recommended to me by someone whose opinion I really value, but I watched it. There's no way I'm staying with this.
It was the acting for me. It just kicked in at two.
And I think for me, too, it was like show two and show three, all of a sudden I was like, I want to come back to these characters. Like, I'm in it. Want to see what happens.
And he's a stone cold killer, but he's like The Sopranos. He's got a family. And he loves his wife. You know what I mean? And he'll close the door and pow, and be like, "It wasn't me." You know what I mean?
All right, just time for dinner.
Total.
You write it definitely very good.
Now let's imagine that you see, I don't know how many scripts to assign, but let's say you see 10 scripts in a month.
Right.
That would be easy for me to see 10 scripts a month.
Yeah.
I'd probably read 10 scripts a month. That's like her for a week.
I okay. know, that's true.
Well, if that is true, let's say you see 10 scripts a week.
Right.
Just how often do you see something where you go, I can't see the technical rules? I don't know what the technical rules are, so I'm just making these things up. But
right.
let's say by page 5, we didn't get this yet. And by page 10, we haven't
been
here yet.
But that's what the process is for. Is like, say, for example, as a current programming executive, right? No matter what, that show was going to hit the air.
Okay.
So it didn't matter how poor the script came in. You had to elevate it because it was going
that
to
show was
the
going,
air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to
so
make it good enough.
You have to take that same attitude with consulting.
Okay.
No matter where you're starting, you're going to elevate that story.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's really what your job is, is to take it there.
Yeah.
It's not as much to identify. By the time somebody gets to you, they do have something.
Right.
It's just a matter of how much polish.
I mean, I would say because, you know, my rates aren't cheap.
You're not cheap.
Yeah. So because of that, I definitely
have
a
out.
Higher
yeah.
caliber of writer who, but occasionally you'll get people who just had their first idea, but financially can afford and want to do that. I love all of them.
Yeah.
Like for me,
whoever
like,
can afford you should be going to university.
Well, let's say that you have somebody who was successful in business.
Right.
And, but their passion has always, they've always desired to be a writer.
Right.
And they don't have the chops yet. They have an idea and they come to you, but all they have is a wheelbarrow full of money.
Right.
And a poorly executed whatever.
Right.
They still got to you.
Right.
They have that wheelbarrow full of money. So that to me is at least some way to say, well, okay, whatever I experienced, whether it was adversity or something.
Right.
I'm bringing something here.
Yes. This is what I feel about story. Like, what, and I've had people ask this question. They said, how do you feel doing what you do, knowing that only, you know, 5 to 8% are going to be working right?
That's a good question.
You know, like, how, and I said, you know, here's my feeling. My feeling is that writing heals. And when story comes through us, we need to tell it. So my feeling is, regardless of the outcome, the story has to come through us. And if I can help in that process, then the story is healing and adding value to that person's life. And there's not, oh my God, there's no value unless I sell this script. But there's value in, I'm going to tell the best damn story that I can tell. Then that's
how every script is not going to sell.
Yeah.
Right. But she's going to make you a better writer.
Yeah. Yes.
So and, the next script.
And that story.
Exactly.
That story is going to make the lesson that you learned in life have a value.
Yeah.
It might only be to you.
Yeah. And you also have to know, like, when, like, I have had what you described. I have had wealthy clients who decide to write at age 50 plus and we'll work together on several meetings and it will get to a point where I'll have to say, and I will say, like, I feel like we've gotten as far as we can on this story. And I don't want you wasting any more money. I feel the story is in the best place that it can be from our work together. Now it's going to be up to you. Do you want to go to another consultant or do you want to move on to something else? And I'll put it in there because, you know, bottom line, I think for all of us is, number one, I mean, we want to work on great story and we want to see story that can evolve to a sale.
It's
that's
not
the
fun
goal.
Reading a bad script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
no
not.
Fun. You want to read a script where you're like,
damn.
Yeah.
You brought up a great thing too. You said it and we just kind of blew by it, but you said they bring me their first idea.
Yes.
Again, first ideas, you haven't put the time in. You know, we talked to a producer, a record producer named Tommy McElroy. He basically created En Vogue with his partner.
Right.
And it looks like on paper, like, oh, I showed up and I started making music and made all this great stuff and that was done. But he spent years, a decade hitting the keyboard, playing and playing. So when the time came and the opportunity presented himself, he was able to say, I've got a million ideas.
Right.
So it isn't just that one idea.
It isn't.
Typically.
You know? But that first idea is special. Because
that's right.
That first idea is what's moving you through the fear of can I write? And do I have something to say?
Yeah.
So even when you have that idea and it's not the one.
Yeah.
It's not your true romance. Yeah. Or it's not your... It's the one that allows you to stand up and say, no, not that one, but I have it.
Yeah, but I can do this.
It's in there, yeah.
You probably teach this also. There's a lot of, like, my friend Bill Todd used to be a big showrunner.
Oh, yeah, Bill's fantastic. You know
Bill.
Yeah.
And Bill was telling me, like, in his book, he has a book out called, what's it called, Pilot?
It'll come to me.
Anyway. But he talks a lot about, when people come to him about his scripts, you know, like, here's a script and I want you to read it, or here's my idea. He always says, okay, that's your first idea. Now bring me two more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Uh-huh.
From the same premise.
Yeah.
Bring me two more ideas from that. Because your first one is usually on the surface.
Right.
Yeah.
And then once you dig deeper, which I know you're all about,
digging deeper.
If you dig deeper, you'd be like, oh. Yeah. I just have this show about these two guys.
Oh, great. These fat dudes like
ice cream. In San Francisco.
But
if I dig deeper, I go, one of them used to be an ex-cop who blah, 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 blah. Then you start adding to the story.
Right.
Yeah. You start realizing he doesn't want to do anything because he was shot 3 years ago.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. It's not, anymore. It's my bad knee. It's not his bad knee.
It's not just your bad knee.
He's gunshot.
But it's a secret you have against him.
Right.
You know what I mean? You start figuring out those things, and that's...
Yeah, Pete.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I got ice cream.
Yeah.
So this goes back to the Tommy McElroy thing, though, right? So it wasn't his first idea. He had a whole catalog of ideas, but he needed that first one knocked out.
And some of those songs were already written before.
Yeah, and he's like, I've been waiting to do this.
Correct.
On a keyboard, but I never had the opportunity.
He didn't have the right voice.
Right, yeah, he didn't have that thing. Yeah.
But you look at the emotional truth of songwriters. Like, you look at Taylor Swift.
Okay.
Chaotic as heck dating life.
Right.
But what a gift.
Oh my boy.
Yeah.
Come from it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
She can't do wrong.
Like, she is on top of the world and rightfully. Like, she is.
Well, let's say she can't do wrong because she's willing to put it there for us.
She is.
She really is. And I think
the heart is out there. Like, it is out there. And I look at so many of these young singers, and Christina Perry, who got known through So You Think You Can Dance, like, bleeds on the page. And it resonates.
Yeah.
This is what people love these songs. Like, when you hear Gwen Stefani just went through a divorce, and people said, but this is when the best music comes up.
Yeah.
So we can't wait to see what they both do with the pain.
Right.
Because that's where story is.
Mm. Pain is good.
Yep.
Wow. I hate seeing Scott Weiland get on heroin, but damn, that guy makes great songs when he's all jumped out.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Since you're talking about the pain, when I first started writing, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, I used to write spoken word, and I used to do it like in a rhyme form, but it always told a story. And eventually when I started writing scripts, it was almost like an easier transition for me. But I remember I only wrote poetry coming from a place of pain.
Yeah.
So when I started writing, I was like, how am I supposed to write when
happiness,
it's not?
Or what do you, what other things?
What I found for me was the first time I sat down and wrote my script ever, I wrote Fade In, because I've been reading scripts since I was 12, because I was an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote Exterior London 1964. And I went, I never want to act again.
Uh-huh.
And that's what helps.
You created the world.
There was that, but if it was a feeling that you get, I know you can relate to this. You guys get it when you play music. You have that feeling when you're on the stage, and you feel like, I felt like I'm sitting on the set with Blur Underwood.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm in my trailer.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, as we all know, only happens a couple times a year as an actor.
Yeah.
Unless you're on a show regularly.
Right.
So
and you get
I was
to have
like,
that
well,
feeling.
I'm feeling this right now as I'm writing this. If I could do this, I never need to do that again.
Yeah.
Because it's just consistent.
Right.
And
nobody has
allowed,
to give you permission.
Yeah. Ooh. And that's what allowed me to realize I never need to feel like I need to be in pain to write.
Right.
Because I get excited when I write.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anyway, I don't mean to change the subject.
I definitely don't think you need to be in pain. I think you need, like, I often, when people first go through trauma, I think they need to absorb and heal before they can write about it.
Okay.
Mm.
So I think that they need to do the emotional work first mm-hmm. so that they can move away from the story and look at the story. I also think, though, that when you are in your rawest form of pain, that writing in journals, which could later go into your scripts,
yeah, you have thing. Something to reference. Yeah. You can't just start doing the writing because yes. all you end up with is Joe Lies.
Yep.
So wow. a different question, yes. same kind of thing. We have a friend that he's in the music industry.
Right.
He works with very, very big bands, and he doesn't have much time to actually write.
Right.
And he doesn't have a lot of time to think. Like, right. He's got time to himself while he's working, doing busy work. So he's got this great idea, but he just doesn't have the capacity
right.
To write it.
Right.
What does he do with this great idea? I mean, it really is. It sounds, John and I both heard the idea. It sounds very fascinating.
You said it's for TV, it's for film?
It's for TV primarily. I mean, you could do a film, but it would be better with a longer arc, okay. you know? So
I want to tell you my answer to this question.
Okay.
Then you can squash
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
Because this is our debate. We've talked about it, and we're good at debating each other
yeah.
because our feelings don't get hurt. Pete says, what does he do with this idea? And I do think it's a really good idea.
Right.
You have to write it. You have to write it. That's it. That's the only thing he can do with it. There's no bring somebody else in, show them my brilliant idea, let them write it. Because he told us the great idea, and my reaction to it was, wow, that needs to get down. And then, you know where I remembered was, I remembered something where Kevin Smith was talking to Ben Affleck about mm-hmm. something. And he had a great idea, Kevin Smith did. And Ben Affleck said, write it. Write it. You should write it. And I think it ended up being one of his best movies.
That's actually how I started writing.
Yeah.
I was on the set working with a huge Oscar-nominated actress. We were in the trailer. Mm-hmm. And she turned to me out the blue and said, what are you going to do? And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, you can't just act. And I was like, well, I got this idea I want to do for this story,
uh-huh.
the true story and how skinheads became skinheads. She was like, skinheads? I was like, yeah. And I started giving her a game. And by the time I told her the story, she was in tears.
Mm.
And she turned to me and she says, you know, nobody's going to write it the way you just told me. And I
yeah.
said, yeah. I said, but I'll when we go back to LA, I'll hire somebody to, you know, she says,
nope.
It's not going to come
it's
from
you.
Here, though.
It's yeah. you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was the best education I ever had.
So now this is just like the reverse of your first question, which
yeah.
was, why are you the person who should write that story?
For this.
And
yeah.
the answer to Pete's question really for our friend is you're the one who has to write that story.
It's your emotional truth that inspired it. So I think to help people move past their fear with that, and trust me, I have people who come to me all the time who have ideas and want writers. And I said, that's not my service.
Right.
I don't do that. Mm-hmm. My writers have their own ideas. I don't connect an idea with a writer. I said, you can go on LinkedIn and join plenty
sure.
of writer groups and people just put it all out there. And it's a great way to do it if you truly are.
That's what you can put it on Craigslist
yeah.
if you want
yeah.
to.
Exactly.
Whatever,
like
yeah.
if you truly are afraid to do it yourself, I think. If you are not afraid to do it yourself, you said this person is so busy. What I would recommend that he do is that he talk about it into his phone memo.
Oh,
just talk about it and then have it transcribed. Just talk the story because that's where he's comfortable and
mm-hmm.
that's what he did well
right.
with pitching it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then have it transcribed and then
expand
begin
on
to write it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
Like when I sold Storyline. My biggest thing was, oh my God, I sold this proposal with 23 chapters.
Yeah.
And I looked at the blank page and I was like,
oh.
You know what I mean? And in the
I need to take a break.
Start by taking a break.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And the fascinating thing was one thing that I heard that just hit it for me was I heard on some book, webinar or something, they said, what you have to do is you have to look at your table of contents and you have to look at the title nonfiction wise for each chapter as being a conversation that you would die to have on that topic.
Oh, okay. That makes it easier.
As soon as it all made sense.
Yeah.
I love to talk. All right. I get that.
Wow.
And in this day and age, especially, you can talk it out. You can talk that whole book, and I don't have to touch a key initially, at least. Right?
And I definitely think there are plenty of people, I work with plenty of people, who people, big people, have very big ideas, and yet they don't want to do it. And so they get a young writer who's passionate and hot off film school, and they work with them. Yeah. So it can happen to where you collaborate if you're truly afraid and have success. But first, you should write it yourself.
I agree.
And register it.
Even if you just write the story. Yeah.
Right, just the story.
Yeah, they don't have to write the actual script. Yeah. But that story would help a writer... Hillary Guest.
Right.
You need
Well, we know a writer.
I mean, I got a little fee and stuff. A little fee.
Yeah. But he happens to be the rewrite king.
The funny thing, he is the rewrite king. The funny thing is, there was an executive at NBC who he had some time off, and he said in New York he started a business where people with ideas would come to him and he'd write them. And I said, that's a phenomenal business.
That is a really neat business.
That is a phenomenal business.
I probably do two pilots a year for producers all the time. Yeah. We're like, we need somebody to write this thing.
Yeah.
We got barely Writers Guild. And I was like, is it going to clear me? They're like, I'm like, then let's go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Comedy, drama, don't matter, whatever it is.
See, like, you within the community, that's great. But for people who are out in middle America
to
know that there's a service where, oh, my God, I have this great idea. And I can go to this person and he can turn it into something.
There's definitely a business there. There's a business there. But I bet it's not free.
No. It can't be free. You know, it's a lot of work.
It's a ton of work.
You wouldn't want free product.
No, you wouldn't want the free product. But the piece that makes it a business is that if your idea is good enough, people, it's worth paying, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, if you have a brilliant idea for a movie or a show or something and you haven't put pen to page, let's be frank, you probably won't. Now, is it such a brilliant idea that if you die and this idea goes to your grave, the world has missed out? You don't want the world to miss out. And if I have him in that position, I'm going to want to pay to put that down. So...
The only thing between the non-working writer and the working writer is the blank page.
That's true. That's why it doesn't matter how old you are in this industry. Yeah. People always say, oh, I'm over 50 and yada, yada, yada. I'm like, it doesn't matter.
That's when your perspective starts getting valuable.
Your script is good. Yeah. People will want to read
King's
that script.
King's Speech, the guy was 73 years old.
You've only started to understand humanity.
Yep. I talk about it all the time. If I had, like... Every year, I probably do two or three different pilots from different producers who hire me. And I actually set up my own little writer's room where I run it like a showrunner from all the different rooms I've been in. And I give young writers a chance to be in a room. And everybody gets paid. They don't get paid what I get paid.
Great experience. Yeah.
You know, and I usually go off and write the actual pilot, right? Now, well, what was that? There was a thought in there somewhere you were just talking about. What were you just talking about?
I was talking about getting the idea out. Just getting it out.
The only thing between a non-working and a working writer is the blank page.
Correct. And so for me, so I go off and I do these things and I give people an opportunity. Here's something that happens every year though. I've done this 3 years in a row. And I probably have done 8 pilots for different producers.
Right.
And I always have a writer's room. Every single year for the last 2 years, I bring in somebody who does film to give them a chance because they're like, oh, I want to start doing feature films. I'm like, okay, come in a room, right?
Yeah.
I could use you. You're good comedy. You're good at whatever. And every year, 3 weeks in, I have to fire.
Wow.
It's happened 2 years in a row. And here's what happened with two different people.
At the three weeks.
You move from TV to film are two completely different things.
Okay.
Film is a lot slower pace. So, Moat, that's why when you get your feature contract, you have all this time to write this freaking feature film. And TV, if you're on a TV show,
you got hurry.
You got 7 days, maybe 10, depending on the show.
Right.
Sometimes you have 3, depending on the show.
Yeah.
And so I taught myself years ago to write super duper fast. I'm going to take up all your time.
Yeah.
So I'll say, okay, here we are with the pilot. We need we have it all beat it out on the board, all the beats on the board. I need you to go off and write the outline. How do you want the outline? Here's an example. Now, when I write an outline, it's like 12, 15 pages deep. Hardly any, all prose, hardly any dialogue at all.
Okay.
I want to see it in character.
this is the 10 story level. You're looking at it.
I want to see it all. It's like act one, you know, or the cold open interior, this room. Boom. I want to spell it out. I want to spell it out. I don't care if it's this big. I want to see it. I want to hear it every little beat. Less prose. Cause and effect. Because this happened, this happened. Because that happened, that happened.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so when I show them my example of my 15-page outline, they freeze. They're like, and I'm like, I need this. Today's Monday. I need this Wednesday. And they're like, when? I'm like, Wednesday. I'm like, what's the problem? This happened 2 years in a row. And they're like, well, can I just go from the beats into the, you know, we kind of already know what it is. Like, no, I need to see it all spelled out. That's just Jake runs to the room and tells his wife I'm fired. You know, that's nothing.
Yeah.
It's all premise moments. I need to get, that's
bring
all plot.
You know,
I need you to spell it all out. So I had to fire two of them in a row. Right. And I'm always telling writers, I know I'm jumping off on a whole other subject. Speed is another thing we never talk
about. Yeah.
When it comes to television, you have to be so much faster in television than you do in film.
Yeah.
So much faster.
In Writers on the Verge, I teach over a 12-week period. Mm-hmm. In the first 10 weeks, they have to write a TV spec and a TV pilot script.
Really?
Yep.
They have to do it quickly.
4 weeks for the TV spec and 6 weeks for
That's a lot
pilot.
Of time.
And they have, and these are people who, some of them have full-time jobs, families. Yeah. That's what you have to learn. To work under those kind of timelines and accountability.
Now, how are you guys doing with Writers on the Verge? What are your odds with getting people on staff? Is it getting better?
Well, we definitely had years. It's interesting. I had dinner with a writer the other night from like 3 or 4 years ago, and he said every single writer in that year, except one,
really?
Is working.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
So I think this year we didn't have as good as last year. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't really know what to factor that with. The great thing about Writers on the Verge is the writer who I had dinner with who's worked ever since, he said he didn't get staffed immediately, but then he did, and then he's worked, actually it's been like 5 years for him. So he's worked ever since. So it's like the great thing about Writers on the Verge is once you're in that family, like even if you don't get staffed that first year, chances of you're getting staffed, if the writing is there, are very high. It's a very high chance.
Really, really difficult to get in now because even I'm sure a lot of your students, once they get on staff, it's hard to stay on staff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now they're doing this paper teaming thing, which is just awful, which is where you and I come into the meeting and I'm the producer and I bring both of you guys on and hire you as a writing team to save money, basically, is how it works. Why are you looking at me?
Because I'm just trying to figure out this process. Do we know each other?
No.
We don't even know each other.
That's not a team. No.
You're hiring. Wow.
And it
happens. Yeah, it happens all the time.
It does.
You know, actually, I didn't even know a guy didn't like that. Anyway, so these things happen all the time.
Dexter did that.
Did they really?
Yeah, Dexter paired writers. They paired writers. Now, I don't know if it more had to do with both people had strong ideas and different story arcs, so they thought bring them together. It's hard to say.
I mean,
goes into it.
And the fight is, this is actually a big argument we have on the education committee all the time.
Right.
Is how do we stop that from happening?
Yeah.
Because now your fee is broken in half to share it with him.
Right.
And even though you don't know each other.
Right.
But when you get a script, you guys are probably going to write it together, or they might even pair the two of you with another co-EP because you guys are still young. You know what I mean? So it happens all the time.
Wow.
But, yeah, it's an interesting
process. Well, just like the showrunner who keeps his name on the script or her name on the script.
There's a lot of those people.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No matter who writes they want their name on every single script.
Wow.
It's in the contract.
Yep.
Wow. Well, we are in the home stretch.
No problem.
Yes.
Let's just close with tell our listeners where they can find you.
If you want to know how to get in touch with me, you can go to www.jengrisanti.com. Contact information, jen@jengrisanti.com.
Terrific. Thank you very, very much.
Do you want to plug any one of your books in particular?
Change Your Story, Change Your Life.
Yes. So my latest book is Change Your Story, Change Your Life, A Path to Success. And it's a complement to Storyline, Finding Gold in Your Life Story. So Storyline is more adding fiction to your truth, whereas Change Your Story is more creating the type of story you want to be living in your life. I highly recommend that you get both books.
Yeah, get them both. We will link both books on our website.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.